You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. Just a quick reminder, this Sunday, 3 days hence, I guess, the Sunday, here in Washington, D.C., at Bus Boys and Poets, the 5th and K Street location, Dan Sisson and I will be doing a book signing for our new book, The American Revolution of 1800, which is really about the American Revolution of 2016. In fact, maybe we should have retitled it. It's an amazing book. It's about how the election of 1800 has so many parallels to today. It's really worth checking out. And also, get your tickets now for Sammy Youssef, September 26th at 8 p.m. at the Strathmore. That's Strathmore, Strathmore.org in North Bethesda. The concert benefits the Foundation for Traditional Studies and features music from his new album, The Center. So just a couple of heads up on things that are going on. John Deans is with us. He is with the Arctic Campaign of Greenpeace USA. No, not the guy who was in the Nixon administration. And, in fact, there's an S on the end here. Twitter, at John Deans or at Greenpeace USA. The website, of course, greenpeace.org/USA. Hey, John, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Royal Dutch Shell is dancing into the Alaskan Arctic, and they're just a little piece of it. You are on this Arctic thing, and you've got this the Greenpeace film Black Ice. There's going to be a special showing tonight on Free Speech TV for Pledge Week, so be sure and check that out. That freespeech.org. If you don't have Free Speech TV on Dish or Direct or through your local cable system, but if you do, there it is. So. John, tell me about Black Ice.
Yeah, Black Ice documents the happenings of about a year ago. Greenpeace has been working for many years now to confront Arctic oil drilling. The Arctic is melting because of climate change, and oil companies responsible for climate change, rather than heed that as a warning, are seeing it as an opportunity to go and extract more hydrocarbons and put our Arctic at risk of oil spills. So about a year ago, our ship, the Arctic Sunrise, went to confront a Russian oil platform operated by Gazprom. And as part of that action, we had climbers who attempted to scale the oil rig. And from then on, the Russian Coast Guard responded in an incredibly dangerous and aggressive way, warning shots fired into the water direct from pistols that had previously been pointed right at the activists, and they rappelled from helicopters onto the ship. They arrested the entire crew, and they put them in jail for 2 months on charges of piracy and hooliganism. They were eventually granted amnesty and released, thankfully. But we're looking back a year now, and the film Black Ice looks at their story, but it also looks at the unfolding drama in the Arctic regions of the planet, and the region that's incredibly vulnerable, fragile, is hurting the most from climate change and is being exploited by oil companies.
Yeah, and now that the Arctic ice is vanishing, oil companies from several of the countries that surround the Arctic are saying, oh, boy, we can do this.
Right, right.
So what's the National Research Council, the arm of the National Academy of Sciences, has put out a report on this. What does that have to say?
Sure, yeah. Last April, the National Research Council of the Academies put out a report, actually partially co-sponsored by the American Petroleum Institute, I'm sure an organization you've talked about a lot on this program, that represents oil companies and lobbies in Washington for the weakest possible regulations on the oil industry. They actually are one of the co-sponsors of this report, and this report said, we don't know what to do about an oil spill in the Arctic. We don't have the infrastructure to respond to an oil spill, and we also just don't have the science to say that we could in any way clean it up. And, of course, that's intuitive to the rest of us. We saw what happened in 2010 with the BP Deepwater disaster in the Gulf of Mexico. We've seen that oil still is in Prince William Sound from the Exxon Valdez, and we've seen the oil spills all across the planet. And of course they can't be cleaned up. And in Arctic conditions, it's even worse. You have incredibly frigid water. You have ice moving in. It's iced over for most of the year. So imagine if at the end of the drilling season there was a big blowout on a rig up there we wouldn't be able to clean it up. It would just stay up in the Arctic. And that's basically what this report said. And yet, companies like Shell are still vying for access to the hydrocarbon reserves underneath the Arctic Ocean.
Yeah. Amazing. So where is Greenpeace going from here on all this?
Right. Well, we're monitoring the situation globally. But there's two really big things here. One is the territory that each of the Arctic nations controls. So in our case in the United States, it's the Alaskan Arctic. It's the waters just off the North Slope of Alaska. We need those areas to be protected and not drilled in. We can't afford to have the oil extracted there. We can't afford the possibility of an oil spill. And so we do need the Obama administration to take a hard look at that and realize and heed the warnings of the National Research Council and say, okay, this is far too dangerous. And we also can't afford it from a climate perspective. Another thing happening on Sunday is there's going to be the People's Climate March up in New York City. And this is going to be the most amazing, display of climate activism I think we've seen in this country and maybe around the world. It's going to be massive. People from all different walks of life and all over the country are converging on New York City to march in support of climate action as Ban Ki-moon holds a summit there, and he'll actually be joining the marchers we've just heard. And this is where people are at. People don't want to see more hydrocarbon extraction and fossil fuels. They want to see clean, renewable sources of energy. So drilling in the Arctic is an anathema to that. We need the Obama administration to heed those warnings.
Is there any indication that they are?
It's hard to tell right now. So what's happening with the Alaskan Arctic is Shell Oil has leases in the Arctic that were granted under the Bush administration, and they're currently tied up in court because the federal government actually messed up on their potential worst case scenario for an oil spill. Essentially, they said there was only, a small amount of oil there, and it turns out there could be a lot more. And so they're having to go back and look at the environmental impact assessment. But I think we're going to see from that the impact is far too great to allow the approval of these leases. So the proof will be in the pudding when the Department of Interior makes its decision this winter on whether or not to approve those leases after doing a supplemental environmental impact statement.
Don't you think that this, along with the Keystone XL pipeline stuff, is basically the Obama administration is holding it until after the November elections, and nobody's really sure if they're holding it until after the elections because it's going to really anger the Republicans or whether it's going to really anger the Democratic base, but one or the other. Doesn't that seem to be the politics of the game that's being played out here?
Yeah, I think that's an astute assessment, and I keep worrying about President Obama's toe as he keeps kicking these cans. I'm worried he's going to bruise it. Mm-hmm. But I think with the Keystone XL pipeline, the can keeps getting kicked down the road, and it's a very obvious political decision, I think, being made there. And here with the Arctic, some of it's tied up in courts, but I think the politics are heavily influencing this, rather than looking at the science and the consensus of people who, we're in New York today delivering messages from over 6 million people around the world to Ban Ki-moon saying, we need to protect the Arctic. We need to set this place aside.
And in Alaska, you've got, because of melting permafrost, you got houses vanishing, sinkholes, all kinds of stuff.
Oh, yeah.
And yet the people benefit from the money from oil. We're pretty much out of time here, but John Deans, is the consensus, the political consensus in Alaska to drill or not to drill?
I think that remains to be seen. I think it's a very dangerous prospect, and especially for the subsistence cultures in the North Slope of Alaska and around the Arctic Circle,
right, who are politically the least powerful, tragically. John Deans of the Arctic Campaign with Greenpeace USA, greenpeace.org/USA. Thank you, John.
Thank you, Tom. Tom Hartman Program.
And we'll be back. It's amazing. Did you know that the country of Colombia has said, okay, enough already to their billionaires?
Fascinating.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And that was interesting. That's Shell Oil, man, a disaster in the making. And why, this is a Dutch company. All the profits are going to go to Holland? Really? That's pretty incredible, too. Coach Glenn. Hey, in State College, Pennsylvania, what's on your mind today, Glenn?
Hey, Tom. Well, I ordered This Changes Everything on Amazon. I've been reading it. And Naomi, you know, like the shock doctrine, this book is even more scary. She's calling for, you know, a Marshall Plan for the Earth, where we might spend trillions. Well, we just blew $2 trillion on a war in the Middle East, and what do we get out of it? Nothing.
We're not even a T-shirt.
No, and this could bring about the social changes we want, because it's going to have the whole world kind of join together.
Yeah, I don't disagree. I from what I understand, I haven't read Naomi's book yet, although we've got a copy coming on the way, because I think she's going to be on our show, on our TV show tomorrow. But the net is that she's actually questioning capitalism.
Absolutely, yeah. Because what we're doing, conspicuous consumption, has to stop in the first world. And the people who are going to suffer first, of course, are going to be the low-lying people, the third world, and who are already suffering from lack of clean water and places to grow food.
Right, right. So how far through her book are you, Glenn?
I'm on page 7.
Oh, so you've just started it. Okay, great.
Yeah, I just got it last. I got it last night, and I had a chance to read a little bit this morning. But the beginning, of course, she lays out her thesis, and it's very clear that we need to have the same kind of mentality about this as we had about apartheid, which wasn't a crisis until the world woke up and made it a crisis. You know, when the banking crisis, you know, it has to be made into a crisis. It's because it's not going to be a little bit of incremental change, and at some point in the future we'll decide to make a change. It'll flip like an iceberg, where all of a sudden the whole climate could just change, and millions of people will die.
Right. It's sort of the mirror image of shock doctrine. You know, with shock doctrine, she was laying out how a disaster is used by capitalists to further enrich themselves, to rip everybody off. And then here she's saying, you know, in order to clean up this mess, in order to save the environment, it probably is going to take a disaster to wake people up. Do I have that right?
Yes, and she also points how easy it is, and she goes through several viewpoints of how people can look at the problem, but we don't want to, we're in denial. It's such a big problem, we want to squint one eye and not really look at it. We'll be activated for a weekend and go to a protest, but then forget that our conspicuous consumption, you know, our driving two cars that eat gas, you know, we're all adding into this, and we're going to have to lower our expectations for conspicuous consumption in the first world while bringing up the third world.
Yeah, yeah. And bringing up the third world doesn't necessarily mean, oh, yeah, let's build a giant dam or a nuclear power plant. Let's do the traditional, quote, economic development. Instead, it could mean let's build schools for girls and put solar panels on them. And leapfrog
exactly.
Carbon. I mean, there's so many things that could be done in the third world, and it could be such a great teaching device for the rest of us in the first world. Yeah, Glenn, always great to hear from you. Thank you very much for the call. We'll be back. It's 20 minutes past the hour. Of Colombia. This in the Financial Times today. Actually, it was September 17th. What is it? Yesterday. Yeah. In yesterday's Financial Times. Mauricio Cardenas, Colombia's finance minister. He's quoting Thomas Piketty, you know, the guy who wrote Capital or the new version of Capital or whatever, you know, saying it's the, you know, the rich are ripping us off. He told the Financial Times in New York between meetings with investors, quote, it is very important to collect revenues from the wealthiest Colombians to be able to invest in security and defense on the one hand and in social sectors on the other hand. Yep, they're going to tax the rich. It turns out Manuel Santos is the president of Colombia, and he's just started his second term. And he kicked off a wealth tax back in 2002, and they're going to expand it. In fact, Mr. Cardenas said, in that sense, we're actually ahead of the curve of what Piketty proposes. You keep in mind, what Thomas Piketty said was that not just a property tax or a sales tax or an income tax or an estate tax. These are taxes that we're all familiar with. Not a VAT tax like they have in Europe and most Southeast Asian countries, but an actual wealth tax where at the end of the year you add up everything that you own, the value of everything you own, and, you know, if it's under a couple $1 million or even a couple $100 million, man, no big deal. But when you start getting into really serious money, then you pay a percentage in tax because that money is a burden on society. When billionaires are stashing money in foreign bank accounts, or that money is essentially non-productive, it's a non-productive asset. We're talking about liquid assets here. When their liquid assets are not being used, it's money that's functionally being taken out of the economy. At a certain level, it is. It's not a total zero-sum game, but it's close. And so they're saying, you know, we're gonna take some of that money and use it to stimulate the economy and make things work. He's only going after individuals who are relatively wealthy by Colombian standards. That means a net worth of more than $500,000 U.S. dollars, which is a lot of money in Colombia. In fact, he says only 50,000 Colombians qualify for this. That's less than fewer than 1% of the population. The president himself is part of that 1%. And he says, okay, cool, tax me. If you have a net worth between $510,000 and $1.5 million, you pay 0.4% wealth tax every year. It goes all the way up to 2.25% if you have wealth above $4 million, which would apply to 45,000 businesses and about 1,000 individuals. He says, at the moment, only around 5% of the population pay taxes, and that's perhaps not a sustainable situation. The time has to be approaching when those are lower income are asked to contribute, even if it's a minuscule amount. So they're going to broaden their tax base, but they're also going to raise taxes on the very rich. Amazing. It's absolutely amazing. He's calling this a peace dividend. Remember our peace dividend? Remember after the Soviet Union fell and George Herbert Walker Bush was talking about, and then Bill Clinton, in fact, the big debate in the election of, what was it, 92? I think was the year that 92 was the year that Bill Clinton was elected. The big debate that year was, what are we going to do with the peace dividend? You know, we've got hundreds of millions of dollars allocated, billions of dollars allocated for the Pentagon. We don't need it anymore. The Soviet Union doesn't exist. So what are we going to use it for? And the Republicans were saying, well, let's give people tax cuts and rebates and, you know, give the money to the rich people. And the Democrats were saying, hey, let's expand Social Security. Let's expand Medicare. Let's invest in our schools. And, of course, what ended up happening was none of the above. Just, you know, what can you say? Down in Florida, Rick Scott, this is hysterical. In Orange County, Florida, the public schools, citing a Supreme Court decision, right? This was a Supreme Court decision. It was called Lamb's Chapel versus Senator Morrissey's Union Free School District. And what SCOTUS basically said was that this was a Christian group that wanted to show films on school property. And they said that forbidding them from doing so based on, you know, official religion, you know, the Constitution, is cutting into First Amendment rights. So as a result of that, two different Christian groups have passed out Bibles in the Orange County, Florida public schools. So now the Satanic Temple has come out with a children's book, the Satanic Children's Big Book of Activities. And by the way, the Satanists are all wearing the upside down star on their chest, on their T-shirt, just like the Republican logo. And they want to go to these schools, and they've got these really cool little cartoon books and teaching kids about Satan worshiping and things. And they want to go to the schools and pass these things out and proselytize for their religion. They say, hey, if you're going to let the fundamentalist Christians in, you got to let us in. We're a legitimate religion. We practice this religion. We've got, in fact, our religion is even older than your religion. So, you know, let us in. And so now Rick Scott and Orange County, Florida, the school board, and they're all going, oh, geez, what have we done? What's next? Right? I mean, if we're going to let religious teachings in our schools, why don't we just invite ISIS over to talk about Wahhabism? That would really make the fundies' heads explode. But I think the Satanists are just plenty. They're just plenty. You know, the flying spaghetti monster wasn't enough. Go with Satan.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Very strange times we live in. But this is the exact logical outcome of what these guys are demanding. Back with your calls, Ed. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. You know, this federal judge, Mark Fuller, who was apparently beating up his wife, Kelly Fuller. When she called, you know, we've heard and seen the 9/11 tapes, you know, where she's like, help me, help me. You know, he's beating me up. And this is apparently, according to his stepson, not the first time that this has happened. In fact, this might be his third strike. Turns out that this is the guy who presided over Don Siegelman's trial. And not only that, he had been a political opponent of Don Siegelman's on a number of previous occasions. They had run against each other, or they had been involved with campaigns that were running against each other. This guy was a political enemy of Don Siegelman's, and he's a troglodyte? He's a guy who beats his wife. And God only knows who else. And he certainly beat Don Siegelman. I mean, not physically with his fist, but when you throw somebody in solitary confinement, you throw somebody in prison, you don't let them appeal, or you don't let them on bail for the appeal. I mean, all of these things. This guy is bad news. So let's keep the focus here on Mark Fuller and the crimes of Mark Fuller and the involvement of Mark Fuller in the Don Siegelman case. If you want the whole story, go to free-don.org. Free-don.org it's just astounding what's going on. Don in Seattle. Hey, Don, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. Just getting briefly back to those workers working in dangerous conditions with dangerous chemicals and things. I wonder if a lot of our workers are living in a culture of fear and intimidation, the companies they work for. I'm just guessing maybe they're asking them to sign disclaimers that would relieve the companies from liability in case they're injured on the job. And not only that, what is OSHA doing about all these terrible working conditions?
Well, OSHA's doing the best they can. The problem is Congress keeps cutting their budget, as they have with the EPA and other federal agencies. Or they flatline their budget for years, year after year after year, which is the effect of a 2 or 3% annual budget cut because of inflation. That's what's going on in terms of coercion in the workplace. I would suggest to you, Don, that in most cases and in most places, you don't need a contract or any kind of written policy to threaten your workers. The threat that your workers are facing, by and large, is the fact that for every one job, there's 50 or 100 people standing in line waiting for that job. Every worker in America feels like, oh my God, you know, I'm totally dispensable. And particularly any worker who's over 40, because there's just this constant flood of young people coming out of school who are, you know, educated and eager beavers and ready to go and willing to work for cheap, and in some cases for free. Yeah. And I mean, you know, this is this slack labor market that is the direct result of insane trade policies and tax policies that reward companies for doing what Mitt Romney did with what was that company? It wasn't Solyndra. It was the one that sounds like it. I mixed them up. But Sensata. Thank you, Jim. That company, I think it was in Ohio, where they literally took the factory apart and shipped it over to China. This was, you know, Bain Capital's thing, and had the employees train their replacement people and all this stuff. I mean, we actually... Nancy Pelosi actually passed legislation to undo that, to do away with those incentives. The Republicans filibustered it in the United States Senate, and so it never went anywhere. But the reality is that 34 years of Reaganomics and free trade policies have created a labor marketplace where people are terrified even without explicit terror. That's the nature of the labor marketplace right now. Don, thank you for the call. Excellent points all. Mary in Spokane. Hey, Mary, what's up?
Hey, not much. I had called for something else, but you had to bring up that stupid Reaganomics again, and I will say, like I keep saying, shock doctrine.
Oh, yeah.
He was born and raised to spread the shock doctrine across the world, and he was the catalyst and the basically the rat with the fleas, as it were.
Yeah.
And everybody's got to realize that.
Yeah.
But when it comes to why I did call you, I'm a 27-year construction veteran mm-hmm. who has built buildings from the East Coast to the West, been in 48 out of 50 states, been in Canada, Nova Scotia, Mexico,
wow.
Virgin Islands. And going off of my years of work, and then I end up having to retire. So I was looking at the world and the United States, and I keep seeing Tornado Alley torn down year after year and all this other stuff. And I asked myself, well, where is your life, land, liberty, and pursuit of happiness if you have to face a disaster every single week? And then the federal government comes in, and you have martial law, federalism, and FEMA, and all that. So where is the community's sovereignty in that point in time? And I was trying to figure it out, and I started looking to building codes because of all my years of construction. And I realized that as I researched building codes, that it went all the way back to the Constitution of the United States, and that there was an inherent constitutional building code implemented when they said that they promised life, land, liberty, the pursuit of happiness and sovereignty. And that John Quincy Adams in 1793 in a court case in Georgia took the courts and closed the federal courts to any lawsuits of citizens or states that felt like their sovereignty was jeopardized by the actions of a corporation or a company or another human being, or their land was poisoned, their cattle was poisoned, whatever. And it also gave birth to the Neutrality Act and the 11th Amendment.
Wow.
And by doing that, this is years of research, if we could just reverse that one court case, from my research, I found that we could get rid of toxins getting dumped in our waters. We can get rid of GMOs, because what it is the inherent constitutional building code implies that the inherent natural rights of mankind come before any man-made right. thing.
I wonder if you could construct something like that around the Takings Clause of the Fifth Amendment, which, you know, says that the government shall not take your property without appropriately compensating you for it. And if government right. policy is leading to the destruction of your property, for example, mile-wide tornadoes as a result of the government not taxing carbon, is that not right. a taking? And are you not entitled to compensation of some kind as a consequence of that?
Yes, and that's what I'm working towards. And then when everybody's talking about the eco this, and like you were talking about the North Pole and the South Pole and the weather thing,
right.
you know, the scientists got to take just as much at fault there, because they went up there in the 1700s and 1800s and broke ice with their ships exploring that had never been broken in trillions and trillions of years.
Well, in like tens of thousands of years.
A block of ice in a bathtub, you know, with water, it's going to melt faster.
Right.
So they had their part in it. But what I was going to talk in the construction aspect is, if you people don't realize that 44 to 40% of the carbons that are emitted into the air every year, over 350 billion tons, is put into the air rebuilding and constructing in the world. And we wouldn't be doing that if we weren't having to rebuild. So what we got to do is create a sustainable architectural building codes. And so what I did is I took my 27 years of construction, and then the last 20 years of my life studying building codes and constitutional law. And I've come up with the inherent constitutional building code that basically states that nothing can be built that would interrupt the natural life of right. mankind on this earth.
Right. And you know, you can go back to the Declaration of Independence where it says nature's God. Mary, I've got to move along, but thank you for that. If you write that up and get it published anywhere, please let us know. And
I have. Just can I tell you one thing?
What's the name of the case in 1793?
That is, I think it's Chisholm versus Georgia.
Chisholm v. Georgia. Okay. Right.
Yep.
Okay.
You can find me online at Build the Flow with Nature, Not to Resist It, because that's what we got to do.
Okay. I got it. Mary, I've got to move along. Thank you for the call. Anita in San Antonio, Texas. Hey, Anita, you wanted to talk about climate change?
Yeah. Hi, Tom. I think combating climate change is going to take a World War II type of effort.
Or a Manhattan Project kind of effort. Yeah, I agree with you.
Well, you know, you look at, like, the car manufacturers at that time.
Yeah.
They manufactured other things.
That's right.
And we can do this. I mean, people grew their own gardens.
Yep.
Instead of war bonds, maybe climate change bonds or something. I don't know.
Yep.
But we can't do it. It's just going to take we're all going to have to come together and realize.
And that's going to take leadership.
Right.
And that's where we've got a small problem. You know, talking about Barack Obama. It's right across the board. And the main thing that's obstructing that leadership is all the money that's coming from the fossil fuel industry, Coke Industries, ExxonMobil, et cetera, that is funding these phony baloney, quote, think tanks, you know, anti-science think tanks and Republican politicians. But, Anita, I totally agree with you. And I think that sometime in the next decade, I'm guessing, it's going to get so bad that people are going to realize that, holy cow, we got to do something because, you know, our civilization is at stake. Anita, thank you for the call. Well said. We'll be back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
One of the finest members of Congress, Jim McDermott, a ranking member of the Ways and Means Health Subcommittee, voted no on the war authorization yesterday. I got to tell you about that as we go through the show. And welcome back, Dave, watching Free Speech TV in Armstrong Creek, Wisconsin. Hey, Dave, you wanted to talk about the Middle East and the CIA?
Yeah, thanks, Tom. We could agree the situation in the Middle East is really complicated, but I'd like to kind of go back in history to an event that I think was really pivotal in where we are today. Back in 1953, Mohammad Mossadegh, the democratically elected leader of Iran, was deposed by our CIA-backed coup on behalf of the British, who had previously controlled the oil production in Iran. This was after Mossadegh decided to nationalize it.
Yep.
Subsequently, the Shah was reinstated, which began our foreign policy of supporting any leadership that basically was convenient to us economically.
Well, this wasn't the beginning of that. We had been supporting Saudi Arabia for long before that. I mean, we had a long history of supporting dictators who gave us their natural resources, basically.
Yeah. I agree with that too. We've been cozying up with, seems like, any despotic leader that was convenient to our interests at the time.
Yep.
Friends became enemies.
Yep.
Enemies became friends. Saddam, Bin Laden,
yep.
The Shah were real prime examples. And, you know, besides the religious extremism, I don't think anybody really trusts us over there with good reason. And, you know, this hatred doesn't just materialize out of thin air.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I just think that we could actually have some normal relations over there if our behavior wouldn't be the way it has been.
Well, this is where I think if we were to take a Marshall Plan approach to the Middle East rather than a Normandy invasion approach to the Middle East, I think we'd get a lot farther along. And I realize conventional wisdom is you have to have both and you start with the Normandy invasion. But when we fought Germany in Europe, we were fighting people who were culturally similar to us, had a similar ancestry to us, had in at least somewhat a common language and religion to us, that we understood each other. We thought the Nazis were nuts, but we understood them. And the average American doesn't have a clue what the difference is between a Sunni and a Shia. Doesn't frankly care. We're in a part of the world where the customs are very, very different. Even interpersonal relationships, you know, the hospitality culture that you find in the Middle East pretty much does not exist in the United States outside of Native American reservations and communities. We don't understand. And then we go in with bombs and weapons of war and say, you know, we're going to make all this right by killing people and not realizing that these, I mean, even the quote bad guys have friends and family in the region, and they're going to be upset when you kill them. I mean, it's just this is why I'm with Jim McDermott. I would have voted no on the McKeon Amendment to approve U.S. military training for the Syrian rebels, too.
I think we really dehumanize those people. We don't even consider them people.
Oh, of course. And why is it that, you know, with the arguably the singular exception of World War II, we are quick to go to war against people who have different religions, different skin color, different, you know, racial heritage. You know, in Vietnam, they had all those slurs for the Vietnamese. In World War II, we were very good at creating slurs for the Japanese. You know, Reagan goes after Grenada. I mean, it's like we have these wars against people who are not like us and are not like the majority, the white power structure in America. Let's put it that way. And it's time for us to stop doing that. It's bad. Dave, thanks for the call. Excellent point. And lest we not forget Mr. Motzen. Ten minutes before the hour on the True People's Media, the Tom Hartman Program, talk media for the rest of us. Stephen in Salem, Ohio. Paul Bremer?
Yeah, you know what? I was just watching some of the talking heads on TV, and they seem to have a memory of 2 to 3 years. They don't realize that in 2003 or 2004, I'm not sure quite, but he was brought over there to reestablish the infrastructure of the country, so to speak. And he put basically 200,000 or 300,000 people out of work who were trained soldiers.
It was more than 500,000, actually.
Yeah, and they became, basically, I think they became the Al-Qaeda or the fighters in... I'm sorry, I can't hear you.
No, I'm listening to you.
But anyways, nature abhors a vacuum. So, you know, we have the surge, we wipe them out, and, you know, what's going to happen?
Yeah, no, we created a massive dislocation. L. Paul Bremer went over. The thing that most Americans don't know and that we easily forget, and frankly, there were only a couple of articles at the time about this, but there were apparently internal communications with Rumsfeld and Bremer and some of the ideologues inside the Bush administration about we have an opportunity here with Iraq to demonstrate how free market principles, because Iraq was a, quote, socialist country. The Ba'athist Party is the Ba'athist Socialist Party, or the Socialist Ba'athist Party. And about half of all the industry in Iraq was owned by the government. Most of it was run by the military, just like in Egypt, and majority-owned or even minority-owned. But the government played a significant role in a lot of Iraqi industry. And so the idea was, we're going to tear down all of that. We're going to do away with everything except for the oil ministry. That was the one building that Paul Bremer, you know, sent soldiers to protect, or George Bush sent soldiers to protect. And we're going to prove that libertarianism works, that if you get government completely out of the way, and they laid off 500,000 people in the military, and then they laid off as many as 2 to 3 million additional people, depending on whose numbers you're looking at, in all these other government-owned industries, idled the factories, shut down business, threw people out of work, stopped the price supports for wheat, stopped the price supports for gasoline, threw the country into a crisis, stopped backing up the banks, and said, okay, now we're, you know, as Don Rumsfeld famously came out and said, you know, democracy is messy, or freedom's messy, but we're going to have now that Ayn Rand libertarian paradise that the libertarians all talk about. We're going to create Galt's Gulch, and we're going to do it in Iraq, and we're going to prove to the world that our Reaganomics ideology of virtually no government, very small government, and a large private sector is just going to work wonderfully. And
oh, boy.
You know, yeah, exactly. And that's what Paul Bremer was all about. Paul Bremer and Wolfowitz and Pearl and all of these guys, they were all about proving that the Chicago School of Economics was right.
And then you get Cheney a month ago saying, oh, Obama, you blew it.
Right, right. Yeah, yeah. Dick Cheney, you know, he doesn't even have the common decency to paint pictures of himself trying to wash the blood off his hands like his I was going to say his boss, but I should call Bush his protege. Anyhow, Stephen, excellent point. Thank you for the call. Patricia in Portage, Wisconsin. Hey, Patricia, what's
Hi.
Up?
Hi. I want to spin off your writing on the wall. We've been warned for decades that we are collapsing ecosystems and driving natural predators and large mammals off this planet, not only on land but in the oceans. Tigers, lions, elephants are being trophy hunted and poached for their body parts to extinction. And,
yep.
You know, I wonder if you know about the Universal Declaration of the Rights of Mother Earth and All Beings, that was drafted in Cochabamba, Bolivia in 2010 during their climate conference after Copenhagen failed. And they presented it to the United Nations in 2011 and put it into their constitutions in Ecuador and Bolivia in 2012. And it says that the rights of all beings, is to exist.
Wow.
And not be harmed by man and not be confined.
Has
by
that
man.
Had the effect of outlawing factory farms in those countries?
You would think. I mean, I don't know how well it's being implemented, but that is the law that we need, is to respect life.
Yeah.
And when you have state agencies funded by killing licenses instead of general public funds,
right.
You have killing businesses exponentially expanding into a libertarian model of free for all, kill for all, do everything you can to destroy life.
Right. In an environment where we're destroying biodiversity, which is threatening to destroy us, and we're doing it very badly and very stupidly.
Right. And, we really need more focus on it, because we have been warned for decades that this is, you know, as serious as climate change, that we can, and in conjunction with climate change, destroying the very web of life that supports all life. And
yeah.
And we can expect irreversible, sudden changes, just like climate change, in the collapse of ecosystems. When you take out large mammals and you erode the entire amphibian and all the invertebrates, all the insect species like pollinators, then you have everything going to hell. You know, we can't continue on this trajectory ignoring the rest of life. You know, you're talking about us attacking people that we don't understand. Well, we really don't understand how other species interact with us and support us, and we're killing them off like they're nothing.
Yep. Yep, I'm totally with you, Patricia, and thank you for the call. There should be a universal declaration of the sacredness of all life, and it's something that, you know, we should be looking at and pointing to in the United States. Stuart Pym did this brilliant thing some years ago. I saw where he pointed out that the Pacific Northwest forests require a certain amount of iodine for the trees to be healthy, and the way that they get that iodine is that bears eat salmon out of the rivers. The salmon came from the ocean, right? And they come up to spawn. And because they came from the ocean, they're carrying iodine in their flesh. The bears eat the iodine. The bears walk out into the woods and poop. And the bear poop with the iodine provides enough of that trace element to feed the forest and keep them alive. And you start killing off the bears and you're killing off the forests. Or you stop the salmon it's like, the web of life is so complex and so interdependent. We really need to learn this.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com, everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com, America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com, Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com, providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Just a small couple of interesting bits of news. This Nicole Flatow writing over at the Center for American Progress's blog, Think Progress. The headline sort of says it all. This is the second week in a row that an American teacher accidentally shot themselves at school. Seriously. Sixth grade teacher Michelle Ferguson Montgomery was injured Thursday morning when she accidentally fired her gun in her Utah elementary school bathroom. The bullet hit the toilet, exploded the toilet, the shrapnel from the toilet got into poor Michelle, struck her leg. She's taken to the hospital. She's in good condition. Good is not excellent, you know. Good means you're pretty badly hurt. But she's not the only one since this year started. Again, I'm quoting from Nicole here, Nicole Flatow over at thinkprogress.org. Last week, an Ohio State University professor shot himself literally in the foot. And apparently he was, and while he was apparently carrying that gun illegally. Oh, Nicole Flatow, thank you very much. The Idaho professor was carrying his gun on the campus pursuant to the new Idaho law that allows people who carry concealed permits to bring their guns to campus. In past years, guns have accidentally discharged at schools in Houston, Texas, La Gardenia, California, and New York City. Right. Just yesterday, the Missouri legislature overrode Governor Jay Nixon's veto of a law that would arm school teachers, the 10th state now to put weapons in the hands of school employees. Did you see this thing a couple days ago where the Department of Defense has given mine-resistant tanks and assault weapons to school districts? Not to police departments, to school districts. We know you can't afford textbooks. We know that your teachers are having to buy school supplies out of pocket. But here, have a tank. We have just gone totally nuts in this country. There's just no other way to describe it. Nuts. Meanwhile, Congressman Jim McDermott, I this really impressed me. Congressman McDermott, it's been a while since he's been on our show. He used to be on a little more regularly back in the early, back in 2003, 2004, 2005, when, you know, so many of us were protesting the war in Iraq, and he was, you know, very much opposed to the war in Iraq. Good guy. He's a psychiatrist. He represents Washington State, one of several, represents Washington State from the state of Washington. He's the ranking member of the House Ways and Means Health Subcommittee. And he issued this statement last night. It was in my email this morning. He says, today, this would be yesterday, today I voted in opposition to the motion to approve U.S. military training and arms for Syrian rebels. This guy's a good Democrat. He's a big supporter of the president. He voted against it. He said, I did not arrive at this decision easily. This is, by the way, a brilliant statement. I have to share this with you. This is brilliant. This is Congressman Jim McDermott. Yeah, if you're going to call a congressman today and say thanks, the switchboard for Congress is 202-225-3121. You can go to callcongress.org. You might want to call Congressman McDermott's office and say thank you for standing up for your principles. He said, I did not arrive at this decision easily. The threat ISIS poses to the people of Iraq and Syria and to the U.S. personnel across the wider Middle East is a serious one. I also empathize with the Americans, with Americans' emotional desire to respond assertively and immediately to the abhorrent murder of our two journalists. And then he tips his hat to President Obama. He said, the president continues to show admirable restraint. His speech last week was careful and thoughtful. However, after much deliberation and reflection on the perils of rushing into yet another military conflict in the Middle East, I decided I could not support the McKeon Amendment. I have said consistently that if the president was prepared to escalate military action against ISIS, he must present Congress with a plan and ask for our support. I am alarmed that President Obama continues to believe he can take action against ISIS on his own authority. Let me just step out of Jim McDermott's voice here for a moment and share with you where the authority is that the president says he has. Back in late 2001, early 2002, I don't remember exactly when it was passed, but this authorization to use military force, AUTM, was passed to give George W. Bush the power to use the military to track down the people who caused 9/11. And it says in the authorization, the AUMF, it talks about finding the people affiliated with Al-Qaeda and any other organization that might have had to do with 9/11. That is still the law. That has not been repealed. And because ISIS, many of the people in ISIS used to be part of Al-Qaeda, and Al-Qaeda used to be, you know, the group that did 9/11, President Obama is saying, I can use this old George Bush authorization to go after ISIS, because they have indirectly something to do with 9/11. That's an argument that I personally do not buy, and apparently Congressman McDermott doesn't either. So, and in fact, back to Congressman McDermott's words, he said, I am alarmed that President Obama continues to believe that he can take action against ISIS on his own authority. This amendment, he's talking about the McKeon Amendment, the one that was voted on yesterday, which is valid only through early December, serves as nothing more than a faux authorization designed to get Congress through the election season. Oh, my gosh, we've got a congressman here who is actually talking honestly about politics. I'm telling you, Jim McDermott is one of the most high integrity guys in the United States Congress. He says, moreover, it addresses only one aspect of the strategy the president outlined last week. This is not a responsible way to conduct public policy. That one aspect, of course, being the military. He said, I remember the last time Congress failed to thoroughly debate a plan for military action in the Middle East. It unleashed a veritable Pandora's box in Iraq and the wider region that we have struggled to contain ever since. The McKeon Amendment calls for the U.S. to arm and train moderate Syrian rebels, some of whom have murky identities and shadowy alliances, and who could, in the not-too-distant future, turn the arms we supply them against the United States. He says, I appreciate this president's thoughtful efforts to respond to the complexities that arose from George W. Bush's irresponsible actions. Wow. But at this time, I will not vote to sanction military action by proxy, even if sanctioned for only a brief period of time. Over the next several weeks, I will continue to urge the president to present his plan before Congress and ask for our support. Keep in mind, the McKeon Amendment, this piece of legislation that was before the House yesterday, basically came out of the Republican conference. It didn't come out of the White House. So Jim McDermott is saying, Congressman Jim McDermott of the state of Washington, the Democrat, is saying, Mr. President, give us your plan and let us vote on it. He says, over the next several weeks, I will continue to urge the president to present his plan before Congress and ask for our support. When this Congress reconvenes in December, when this amendment expires, I will push for a robust and deliberative debate. Keep in mind that the amendment did pass. It now goes to the Senate. It's going to be very interesting to see what happens over in the Senate. He says, when this Congress reconvenes in December, when this amendment expires, I will push for a robust and deliberative debate over a new authorization for the use of force, one that is limited in scope and addresses the whole of the president's plan. After a decade of reckless military action, this is the only responsible way to proceed. And he is so right. He is so totally, totally, totally spot on right. This is Congressman Jim McDermott standing up and making a principled argument against this. And now the vote, I don't have the count right in front of me, but it was 200 and change to 150 and change. And most of the people voting against it, or many of the people voting against it, were Democrats. But again, this was not a bill that the White House was saying, here's exactly what we need, please vote on. So it's a very, very messy situation. Mimi Kennedy is with us. She will be up next. Stick around. We'll be right back. 15 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Mimi Kennedy is up with us next. Stick around. She'll be right. We'll be right with her. And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And in the studio with me, I am pleased to introduce or to welcome back. You've been on our program before, haven't
you?
Just not here in the studio.
Not here in the studio.
Yeah. So Mimi Kennedy, the activist, the actress, or actor, what's the proper term?
I do say actress sometimes because I play female roles mostly.
Yeah. I don't know where that word, you know, how
yeah,
that word
me neither. There was a big
right
switch.
Days.
We all have to be actors, but yeah. Actress is kind of the historic term.
Okay. So anyway, and you're brilliant at it.
Thank you.
And the new show that you're in is Mom.
Yeah, Mom. Having a good time with Allison Janney and Anna Faris on the network, big network.
Doing the TV show. That is spectacular. So, Mimi, you're on the board of
Progressive Democrats of America. Yeah, we had our round table yesterday. Thought it was going to be about labor. It was a little bit about labor, but it was mostly about war and peace. Really interesting vote yesterday that you were just talking about.
Yeah.
We were looking at our PDA board, and Jim McGovern visited us at the round table, and he said, I'm really glad to be among friends. I need to know you have my back for the vote that I'm about to vote. Because, of course, the sense was that the Democratic president should have the power he needs, just the way the Republican president sees it, to have war all the time. But, of course, he did not. He said, this may be the only vote we get on this war. And he's old enough to remember Vietnam. He voted no. Some of our champions, Keith Ellison, voted yes, but then again, Syria. He was going to give the president, because I think of his district, there were unbelievable amounts of populist Republicans who voted no, and therein lies the common ground that we begin to see. Strange bedfellows indeed. There's a guy named Dana Rohrabacher was on C-SPAN this early morning. I was listening on my radio C-SPAN. Talking about why he didn't want a war. And I'm telling you, it was like, are you using our talking points, Mr. Rohrabacher?
Shades of 1943.
Because he didn't used to be like that, but I know he's got young kids. He had twins later in life. I happen to know this because I once, Walter Jones, another anti-war Republican, was talking with Mr. Rohrabacher outside Capitol Hill while I was with Conyers' staff. Uh-huh. And I heard them talking about kids and so forth. It was all very paternal and familial. But now, it must be 7 years after that conversation, Dana Rohrabacher doesn't seem to want to send young people to war. James McGovern,
he's also secure.
A wonderful vote. Lee, of course, you know, voted against.
Probably.
So what I think I'm trying to say is yesterday the halls of Congress were grim because there was a palpable energy. We're going to go to war. We're going to do something. Ha ha ha. But then I saw the Senate floor, not the House floor right after the vote, and there was a lot of men's club look to the Republican side, a little more diverse on the Democratic side, but there was a mixed energy. Nobody was saying, like, yeah, we can go to war happy, and nobody was saying, like, yeah, we have an anti-war vote and we managed to stop it. It is a fertile time for activists on Capitol Hill.
Yeah, very well said. And there's a lot of ambivalence
right
across the board.
So if you're principled, and you know what your principles are, and there's a principled vote to be cast, it's a very good time to call your congressman and senator.
Right. And right now, call your senator, because this
your
vote
senator
is now migrating over to the Senate.
Yes, it is.
And, in fact, we have a website, callcongress.org, which lists a few 800 numbers as well as the regular phone number for the Congressional Switchboard, which is 202-225-3121. We'll be right back with Mimi Kennedy. Stick around. Here with you, and Mimi Kennedy is with us, the actress, actor, activist, writer, board chair of Progressive Democrats of America, pdamerica.org, star of the hit series Mom on CBS, and Mimi, so glad to have you in the studio with us. It is great. We were talking just a minute ago about how the war vote happened in the House of Representatives. You were down there yesterday.
Yes, I was. Yeah, I was down there for the Progressive Democrats of America's monthly roundtable. It was supposed to be about labor.
Right.
It became about war and peace. Jim McGovern dropped in before he voted against this authorization for special training for troops in Syria and armaments. And he said, it's good to know that people have my back. The ultimate vote was an amazing mix of populist Republicans sounding like progressive Democrats, and some regular Democrats. There were other Democrats that wanted to give the president what he had asked for because he's their president.
Well, and also this expires in December, so it's just
indeed.
Really, let's get us past the election. So you probably had some Democrats who were just, I mean, you as a member of Congress, you have two obligations. You have to represent your district first and foremost, even if they disagree with you. And then you also have to do what's best for the country, you know,
that's right.
Even if it disagrees with your district. And so, You know, like Keith Ellison, he probably represented a district where they were like, hey, you know,
I think
kick
so.
Their butts.
I think so. Exactly right on that vote. Well, Jim McGovern did say, remembering Vietnam, he said, this may be the only chance we get to vote on this war. And Alan Grayson was saying this may end up to be a very insignificant vote, just as you say, something with a time limit. In December, people will forget that it ever happened. That's the kind of tipping point we're at in history right now in these last 2 years of the Obama administration.
Yeah, it's a really fascinating time. Progressive Democrats of America, Tim Carpenter used to come on all the time.
I know.
Talk about PDA. We love Tim here, and we're so glad that you can come on. What is PDA up to? And PDAmerica.org. If you're not a member, call or go to their website now and join. You start a local chapter. This is one of the best on the ground across the country. Progressive. It's not affiliated with the Democratic Party. It's all about taking over the Democratic Party and influencing the Democratic Party and pushing the Democratic Party to become a, you know, this is the Democratic wing of the Democratic Party, to paraphrase Howard Dean.
The Howard Dean.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
Tim used to say, we're not the Democratic Party. We're what we want the Democratic Party to be.
Right. We're the insurgency inside the Democratic Party.
The insurgency
Party.
Inside.
And so what's PDA up to? You had a roundtable. A lot of people don't even know what that is.
Yeah.
So
Tim Carpenter, our founder, got this together. He made so many friends in Congress who were so excited to have a principled person coming and you know, talking their ear off. We have 6 congressional board members, and one of them got us a room every month in the Cannon building.
Mm-hmm.
And we meet with other progressive groups and coalition. We've had the National Nurses United. We've had too many to name. We've had Food and Water Watch, environmental, labor, anti-war, and certainly the peace movement, all there to talk to congressional members and staff. And we share education. Us from the grassroots, here's what the grassroots are really going to be mobilizing about in the streets, and them saying, here's the legislation, we'd like to propose this, how does this, so, you know, we the people get into the room and counterbalance what they see day in and day out from paid lobbyists who are making 3 figures a year to talk their ear off about what their corporation wants or what their consulting firm wants.
You mean 6 figures a year.
They're not making.
It's amazing when Ronald Reagan came into this town, there were like 400 registered lobbyists. Now there's like 37,000, and starting pay is $135,000 a year, and that's like basically for an intern.
It's unbelievable.
This city is so awash in cash.
So awash in cash. I do notice that. You walk the streets, and people are living very well.
Oh yeah, and you can't get a decent meal in a decent restaurant for under $200,
no,
and you got to have a reservation.
That's exactly right.
It's like I've never. It's the bubble.
It's the bubble, and you can get very puffed up here, treating yourself very well. I sometimes call it Country Club America, with the White House as the clubhouse, which is why people who think like that are so mad when they don't have the presidency, because that's the main place.
Yeah,
you know, for the fun and the power. And I don't mean to dominion, you know, make it into diminutives, but there is a source of pride. In all that, I'm from show business, don't I know? The same thing happens in Hollywood.
Well, they say Washington D.C. is show business for ugly people.
I used to say that, but they're very attractive here. With a few exceptions. But anyway, you know, I did notice that John Boehner couldn't be bothered to gavel the vote on War and Peace.
Really?
I walked in there. It wasn't Boehner at the lectern, and I said, "Where's Mr. Boehner?"
Must have been happy
hour. He wasn't here. Maybe. But I said, he can't be bothered, and maybe he said he's probably in his office. And I went, well, why isn't he? This is an important vote. He's sending young men to war.
But he's got a wet bar in his office, and he smokes in his office. So, you know.
So he's in his office, they said. And the guy next to me went, well, no, an hour ago, I saw him taking pictures in the hall with a visiting group. So he was receiving visitors, but he couldn't gavel the vote about the war.
Wow.
What?
We have a little less than a minute. What are you hearing about what's going to happen when this hits the Senate?
I have not heard very much. It's really come up by surprise. So my speculation would be there's maybe enough pro-military industrial votes in the Senate to put it over.
But it
I
would
don't
take,
know.
You know, if it's close,
yeah,
if one Democrat decided to filibuster it.
To filibuster it.
Yeah. Yeah. It's going to be really interesting.
I haven't. Have you heard that about the filibuster?
I have not.
I've been
no,
in
I'm,
this bubble,
I'm,
and I
I'm
haven't.
Just purely speculating. We're going to have Senator Sanders on for an hour
Maybe
tomorrow.
Maybe we'll have
we'll
a caller. A caller could call
in? Yeah. And in fact, if you would like to call in, Mimi and I are going to take calls now. So if you'd like to talk to Mimi Kennedy with Progressive Democrats of America, give us a shout right now. 866-987-TOM.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Oh, yeah. There's that boat. Mimi Kennedy coming up next. In the meantime, check out pdamerica.org. Check out their website. Sign up. We'll be right back with Mimi. Welcome back. 28 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. And, I would say it's your opportunity to talk to a famous TV actor and star of screen, stage, and movie. But but really, you know, that's
important.
You have an impressive and important career. But your activism work blows me away. I mean, the fact that you have been with PDA through all this, the stuff that you've been doing, and now, you know, taking on this responsibility with Progressive Democrats of America, Mimi Kennedy, it's such an honor and a pleasure to have you with us. And pdamerica.org, the website. Shall we take some phone calls?
I think that would be fun. I listen to you on the radio do it all the time.
Let's
and
do
it's
it.
Great to be here watch you do it.
Charles in Opa-locka, Florida. You're on the air with me and Mimi.
Hi, Mimi. How you doing?
I'm doing great. Good to hear your voice.
Indeed.
Okay. Well, I'm excited. But the thing is, I do have a question for you. What happens if, just in case, the Republicans win the Senate, and they might try to impeach the president, but the most important thing is, what happens if they decide to shut the government down again? Does the Democrats actually come out with town hall meetings, which we didn't have? Which the Republicans came out effectively with the Affordable Care Act, with the Obamacare, and they made such a stink.
Mm-hmm.
And it seemed like we missed a valuable, we missed that time. And when they shut the government down, what about our constituents? What about the people that was affected so much by the government shutting down that need, you know?
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
So let's get Mimi's thoughts on this, Charles. Excellent point. Thank you.
Yeah, Charles, you know, my first thought always is, being of an organization that organizes town halls, every time that we would have one, we had to raise money from activists in order to get $600 worth of plane tickets for a couple of people. We had to rent a venue. That would be another $800 to $1,000. You know, it costs money for the activists to do that, so the Democratic Party should be doing it. So where's their, you know, $4,000? Where's their budget of $20,000 to do a bunch of town halls everywhere? I'll tell you where it is. It's in their campaigns, because we're not funded the way the right wing funded their anti-Obamacare message. That Koch brothers money, that billionaires money that you hear about, sometimes it pays for plane tickets and buses and town venues. I know this intimately because I'm somebody who has to raise the budget. That's one. Now, I don't want to blame it all on money, but it is very, especially since the Democratic Party has some money and they should be putting it into town halls and things that regular people can come to.
Oh, this whole Tea Party thing was that. I mean,
the Tea Party was funded.
I went to two Tea Party meetings down here on the Mall.
Yeah.
And in both cases, there were these buses showing up that were painted.
Yeah.
I mean, not just a bus that was rented.
Yeah.
Painted. That's a $300,000 paint job
on this
thing. That
is a $300,000 paint job on the bus. There's people that are told that they can take the day off if they go to that thing, whereas Democrats are scrambling for child care and figuring out how they can get there. I have seen a vast difference. The income inequality in this country also exists in terms of organizing. But Charles, that's such a good idea that we're going to try to do it anyway. And if they do shut the government down, yes, there should be town halls on here's how this happened and here's who to blame it on. It's not just Congress. We hate them all. Throw them all out. No, we can name names. It's specific strategies from specific Congress leaders and Senate leaders and GOP leaders. But they are funded to have their populist town halls look like organizing.
Yeah.
And it's not the same organizing we do, because while we organize, we have to fundraise and scrape together from, you know, people who can't really afford it. $25, $50, $500 from those who can't afford it.
Yeah, that's got to be the toughest work of PD America. It's just keeping the thing going. Dave in Cherry Hill, New Jersey. You're on the air with Mimi Kennedy and me.
Hello, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
And Mimi, it's a pleasure to get a chance to talk to you.
Thank you.
You're talking about whether or not we should go to war again or still. And I think we need to ask, why do we go to war nowadays? Not just why are we going to this war?
Yeah.
Because it seems clear to me that the only reason we go to war anymore is to make money for certain corporations and certain individuals.
Yeah.
And when you see it that way, it becomes obvious. I mean, it doesn't make any sense. Why did we go to Iraq? Why did we go to Afghanistan? But if you realize that the reason we went there was to make money, it makes sense. They made a lot of money.
Yeah.
I keep thinking all the way back to Marco Polo and the Silk Road. Trade routes. Who controls trade? If you're a nation state, you want to be in the government because you get the benefits of the trade. And of controlling the economy, and I think you're absolutely right, although we might have once said it's for oil, literally the oil that's under the ground of the geopolitical place that we're trying to get a government to control that's friendly. At this point, we can see in our own case, who needs a government when you've got mega corporations that can do what they want? That's what the Trans-Pacific Partnership is all about. They would be corporations can sue nation states for passing laws that protect the people environmentally, but the corporation doesn't want those laws because it affects their profits. That would be okay under the Trans-Pacific Partnership. So when I think of the world map, I realize, we're kind of in a trade war about controlling the means of production. There's a lot of old language that you could apply to this. But fighting neck and neck is the idea of human rights, human dignity, and a global brother and sisterhood of man and womankind. And that's really kind of what's going on. I think you're absolutely right. But what I would used to say was a war for oil, I would now say is a war to control trade, safe trade, trade routes. And it's an arms race. Every time you think, we'll fly things everywhere. And then somebody has a shoulder launch, bring down the airplane missile. Okay, then we're going to have the – that's why I think Russia wanted Crimea. They wanted that shoreline.
Yeah. Well, that's where their navy is based.
Yeah, exactly. And they needed to have that shoreline for every reason.
Yeah, it's an amazing
thing. Yes. Short answer, yes.
Okay. Frank in Buffalo, New York. You're on the air with Mimi Kennedy and me.
Thanks, Tom. You know, you and I don't see eye to eye on a lot of things, but I love your show because you give such a reasoned approach, and it's well thought out.
Thank you.
I got to disagree with that prior caller. I can't see how we... The Iraq war cost us trillions of dollars, 7,000 people since 9/11. I mean, to me, the reason is this emotionalism that you'll see now with this ISIL thing was not really stoked up until they started using YouTube in these beheadings.
Yep.
And
Boko Haram is actually larger, more powerful, and more destructive, and we're doing nothing about them because they're not doing videos.
Right. You know, Tom, they are the JV, these guys. Just like the 9/11 guys were the JV.
Yeah.
And there was a thought at the time that we should look at this as a criminal action.
Yeah.
And those guys were laughed at. And you look back at it now, those guys were right. And that's how we don't need to go to war with these guys. They're way undersupplied, overextended. We could take them out. But who's going to wind up the benefit of that? Bashar Assad in Iran? And people get all stoked up emotionally that the president has to man up and do this, and they're not even thinking straight about this stuff, you know? And that's what bothers me the most, is that the lack of critical thought in this country, and that these guys can be elevated to these brave warriors because they cut off heads and put it on YouTube, or they managed to, as horrible as it was, to crash two planes into the three planes, four, on 9/11. And since then, how much homeland terrorism has there been?
Yeah, we have spent a fortune. Frank, let's get Mimi's thoughts on this.
Well said, Frank. Really articulate. That is the other piece that is fueling. You know, when you ain't got nothing, you got nothing to lose. And I have often thought about the many displaced people in Asia and the Middle East that we've bombed. You know, the bombing, not just we, but all that violence has created a massive amount of refugees and displaced people. And maybe a 5-year-old kid is now grown up to be 14, 15, 18 over this time of war. And what do they got? They've got their religion. They have a sense that their family needs some sort of vengeance, and it's going to be very attractive to then become a fighter and just lose your life for your God because God is on your side. And I'm not denigrating that feeling, although it's so dangerous for us, but we have had it on our side too. So I agree with you. It's not entirely money. It's not. There's also human feeling that causes people to want to go to war. But when you look at Congress in their fine suits and their marble halls, just with a sweep of the hand, let's have more war. That's when my heart breaks.
Yeah, me too. And this, I shouldn't ask you to read bin Laden's words, but this is Osama bin Laden.
Yeah.
The week of the John Kerry, George Bush election. He released a video, as you'll recall. And he said, "We are continuing our policy of bleeding America to the point of bankruptcy, Allah willing. We, alongside the Mujahideen, bled Russia for 10 years until it went bankrupt and was forced to withdraw in defeat. All we have to do is send two Mujahideen to the farthest point or east to raise a piece of cloth on which is written Al-Qaeda in order to make generals race there to cause America to suffer human, economic, and political losses without their achieving anything of note other than some benefits for their private corporations." He says, "Every dollar of Al-Qaeda defeated $1 million by the permission of Allah, besides the loss of a huge number of jobs. As for the economic deficit, it has reached record astronomical numbers, estimated to more than a trillion dollars. And then he nails it. He says, "It is true that this shows that Al-Qaeda has gained. But on the other hand, it shows that the Bush administration has also gained something that anyone who looks at the size of the contracts acquired by the shady Bush administration-linked megacorporations like Halliburton and its kind will be convinced. It all shows that the real loser is you. It is the American people and your economy." This is Osama bin Laden. We are doing exactly what these guys want. ISIS is playing the exact same playbook that bin Laden did. You know, we're going to send two fighters to a distant, well, in this case, we're going to behead two guys.
Let's defy them. Let's resist them. Let's not do this.
Really. And let's stop listening to John McCain and Lindsey Graham, who are saying, thank God for the Saudis because they're arming the people who became ISIS. I mean, it's nuts. Anyhow, we'll be back with Mimi Kennedy. Pardon my going off on a rant there. We'll be back with Mimi Kennedy, Progressive Democrats of America, PDAmerica.org, right after this.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And check out PDAmerica.org, as in Progressive Democrats of America. PDAmerica.org. We'll be right back. And welcome back. Tom Hartman and Mimi Kennedy with you. And Kim, watching Free Speech TV on the Dish Satellite TV Network in Mooresville, Indiana. You are on the air with Mimi Kennedy. Hey.
Hi. Kim? It's so nice to talk to both of you.
Thank you.
I need your help. I'm very active in local politics. I film a Hoosier, and I now live in a deep red state. I'm running for local office for town council, and I'm encountering a lot of Republicans. I'm in a unique position. I have an unpopular Republican opponent.
Okay.
What I would like for you guys to maybe, I get a lot of, well, how do you feel about Obamacare? How do you feel about you know, gun control, mm-hmm. all that kind of stuff. And I'm mm-hmm. just wondering if you guys could just give me some quick, you know, polite rebuttal to these arguments.
Obamacare is good for families, and abortion has nothing to do with it. So if your concern is about children and children to come, then Obamacare is probably something you want because it helps mothers and children much more than you can't use federal dollars for abortion, period. Second, I would say on the guns, Dennis Kucinich used to say, "I'm not going to take away your guns."
Right.
That's all he would say.
Yeah. Bernie Sanders, Kim, does a brilliant job on this. He's on here every Friday for an hour taking calls and has been doing that for 9 years. And hundreds of times people have called and asked Bernie questions about abortion, about these wedge issues the Republicans come up with. And Bernie will say, well, you know, a lot of people care about that. But the real issue is the fact that the middle class is dying. The real, you know, and he always takes it back to economics mm-hmm. because economics is really at the base of everything. And these wedge issues that the Republicans keep coming up with, things like gun control, they're there so that we won't talk about their economic policies. So I would strongly recommend moving along to those. Does that make sense to you, Mimi? Thanks, Kim, for the call. Good luck.
Yeah, good luck, Kim. Yeah, I drove through upstate New York once, and I heard a nun, I was educated by nuns, on the radio for 3 hours talking about the evils of Obamacare only because of abortion. This woman sounded like she was about 90, and I guarantee you she doesn't know the science probably behind any kind of reproduction.
Well, and she didn't know the legal, I mean, you know,
no, but
the Hyde Amendment.
She was telling everybody you have to vote against all Democrats and against Obamacare. So that is out there, but it is neither scientifically damaging. The real scientifically damaging thing to families and children and mothers is not having health care.
Yeah, a.k.a. the Republican Party. Mary in Spokane, Washington, we have just a minute to the break. You have a quick question for Mimi?
I really liked how she brought up the human feeling of things when it comes to war. Because not many people even realized that Madam Albright, just before the Twin Towers, had made a speech that I think it was like 50,000 Iraqi children could die before the United States will lift a finger.
Mm-hmm.
And just after that, that all hell broke loose. That, you know, in the
she was talking about sanctions.
Wasn't call. Yeah. Yeah, and that right after that, all hell broke loose, and Madam Albright disappeared to Florida to deal with the. She retired and went to Florida, and then dealt with the young boy down there that was wanting to stay in America,
Elio,
taken back to his home country. Yeah,
you're saying, how do we know that our words don't go around the world? Of course they do. Things that Americans say flippantly like that. She said the price was worth it. Bye.
Yeah. It's amazing. Mary, thank you for the call. We'll be back with Mimi Kennedy, the board chair of Progressive Democrats of America, pdamerica.org. Minutes before the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Talk media for the rest of us. And Mimi Kennedy is with us, the actor, her new show, or the show that she's part of, Mom, on CBS, but more important in my mind, board chair of Progressive Democrats of America, pdamerica.org. And Bob in Arlington, Washington, you have a question for Mimi?
Yes. You know, and some of the things that I've encountered in my life shows me that far too much of our labor policy and how we do things is dictated by the insurance companies and insurance policy,
mm-hmm,
rather than actual safety practices or, you know, so how much of our economy has been squelched because of the insurance policy, and what can we do about it?
I'm the daughter of a lawyer, and I have always said liability, liability, liability.
Yeah.
Just like follow the money, follow the liability, and he's right. You will see a core of our legislation in almost any area you choose to look at, including labor. And what the corporations fled America during the Reagan era, partly because they didn't want the environmental liability that they could see coming, and partly because they didn't want to be responsible for worker, for liability, for harming workers. They wanted workers who were just going to shut up.
Right.
Liability, as much as cheap labor, is what made corporations, is what killed the American economy. And it was so selfish and so venal that it should have been called out when it happened, but it wasn't. And I appreciate your observation, because it is, I would just say, start to practice that. Look at liability, liability, liability.
But the flip side of that is you get Republicans like down in Texas where they say, well, okay, you know, these doctors are being put out of business by the
liability insurance.
Liability insurance,
yeah.
So having to do with malpractice.
Yeah.
So we're going to cap it at $250,000. No matter,
yeah,
what kind of damage they do to you, you get $250,000.
Yeah.
They did that. It really hurt a lot of people, and it didn't reduce the liability insurance policy.
Well, these
policies.
Are the guys who don't want regulation, and then what do
right.
they do? They regulate that if you're hurt, you can't get the amount of money it takes you to stay alive with 24/7 nursing
right.
care.
So,
yeah, so wrong solution.
Right, yeah,
there.
So maybe more than insurance reform, we need regulatory reform.
I think we need regulatory reform, absolutely. Yeah. And I think that we need to say, to have it global. I mean, that's ideally, you don't go places and harm people or the environment, it's going to come back to us.
Right.
Live with our regulations,
there
please.
You there you go. George in Chicago, listening on WCPT. You're on the air with Mimi Kennedy.
Well, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I would like to make this point in regards to the earlier caller who brought up the subject of town meetings. We do have a critical imbalance in funding between the right and the rest of us, same normal people over here. And we've got to maximize the advantages we do have.
Mm-hmm.
And one of those is the voice of the man who commands the biggest microphone and the biggest pulpit in the country, and that's the president. And I have been endlessly frustrated with him as a fellow Chicagoan and South Sider that he is so unwilling to engage, so unwilling to fight hard battles. You know, you've made the suggestion, Tom, that he should sit in a room and watch and listen to the speeches of Roosevelt and Truman and channel them and come out with the fighting attitude they had.
Yeah. But that's, you know, it's not going to happen. I think we have the president we have, George. Do you want to just complain about him, or did you have a specific suggestion or question?
I say that leaders have to lead. And if you want to inspire people to go to meetings and come to the polls, you've got to engage the Republicans. And when they're screwing with you, you have to fight back.
Yeah. I agree.
Okay, I'm with you. Yeah, Mimi, you want to expand on that?
I just agree. Well said. And, you know, Obama doesn't fight back because he wants to be the president of all of us, because we had 8 years of an extremely partisan president who wasn't the president of all of us at all, and everybody saw it. So I think Obama's idea was, I really will be, and therefore I'm not going to fight back. But that was, I think, a really awful decision, and it left the country disheartened. I was disheartened. It's been very difficult, an uphill struggle for activists, because we have a president of the Democratic Party who doesn't represent what we know, I think, he would like to represent. Yeah. I think he would. I just saw a play about his mother, Obama Mama, Stanley Ann Dunham. You know, she was a hippie and a global human rights in her heart. I don't know enough. I haven't seen the whole play, just three scenes. But no question, he was raised by somebody who had very big ideas about global human rights. But, you know, he's president of corporate America right now, he is.
It's a tough one, yeah. James, we have 2 minutes to the end of the hour. James in Spring City, Tennessee, you're on the air.
Yes. Is it my imagination, or is it, if you do a little homework, you notice a lot of the Republican-controlled states have gerrymandered in the past 4 years?
Oh, yeah. Everybody everywhere. So is your question, what do we do about gerrymandering?
Yeah, I guess so. And maybe those that voting Republican might think twice about why they're voting Republican this year.
great plan.
Yeah.
James, thanks for the call. Mimi, we have a minute and a half here.
Great plan. Well, you know, speaking of voting, what I have been saying is, as a wife of a teacher, it's occurred to me many people feel that voting is a test. They don't have all the answers. They would rather avoid the test, just as they might have in school. This year, first, do no harm. It's a great idea if you're facing a ballot and you don't want to harm by voting for somebody wrong just because you like their name. But you will harm if you don't vote in the federal races in November. Everybody who's ever voted has to vote in November for those federal races. Think twice if you think the Republicans are on your side. If you're a working person, you're not a billionaire, you should be pulling the lever for the Democrat in those federal races, or we're going to see impeachment, our money squandered on investigations, not showing up to gavel. We're going to see all that stuff that makes us hate the government, and we need our government. We should love our government because it's us, self-government. We need to use it. So first step, November, vote, and look at those Democrats. Find out about them in your area.
And look at the local races, too. I mean, the Koch brothers are now funding state-level stuff. They're even funding, like, local judges and things.
Absolutely they are, and they can easily take over those little small places if you're not looking. And they're mostly doing it in the GOP, safe to say. So what I'm saying about the federal goes with the down ballot, too.
Yeah, get involved. Show up.
Yeah.
Which you've been doing all your life, and we're so pleased that you're here with Progressive Democrats of America, PDAmerica.org, Mimi Kennedy, the board chair. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you so much, Tom. What a privilege it is to be on your show.
And don't forget, Mimi's. You can watch Mimi on TV, on CBS, on Mom. When is that?
Yeah, it'll be on Monday nights, I think.
Monday nights.
Coming up
How
soon.
How cool is that? There you go. Okay. Thanks, Mimi. We'll be back. With Dan Sisson is going to be.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters: Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com, America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com, Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com, providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartmann.com.
You're listening to the Tom Hartmann Program.
And welcome back, and welcome to Tom Hartmann University. Our history lesson begins right now. The required textbook is The American Revolution of 1800, How Jefferson Rescued Democracy from Tyranny and Faction, and What This Means Today, by Dan Sisson, with a foreword by me. And Dan is sitting right next to me. Dan, it's great to have you with us.
Well, thank you, Tom. It's good to be here.
And you... Tell me your, I'm sorry I don't have it written down here. You are a professor of...
Well, I'm above departments in a way. I don't belong to any department. I'm just wandering around the university and teaching what I am qualified to teach in.
Wow.
And that has to do with things like, honors, and I teach in the engineering department. I teach a lot about technology. I teach courses on terrorism and revolution. And I've been very fortunate at Eastern Washington University that the deans have been very understanding and given me complete freedom to do something with integrity.
Wow.
It's a marvelous opportunity.
That's great. So this book, I read this book. I didn't know you. And right. I was working on a book called What Would Jefferson Do, as I recall. Maybe it was another book. But anyhow, I came across a reference to this book in some research that I was doing, and I went looking for it, and it was out of print, and so I bought a copy, a used copy on ABE Books, and read it. Just sat down for the weekend and just read it all, from mm-hmm. all the way through. And it blew my mind, the things that I didn't know about the election of 1800 and how the founders thought government should work. Stuff that is so important and relevant for today. So let's begin at the beginning. What was the Revolution of 1800 and why is it consequential?
Well, the Revolution of 1800 was the first time in the history of human origins in which a government changed power without violence and bloodshed through the electoral process. And the Revolution of 1800 is virtually an invention by Jefferson and Madison as a way to bring about the decentralization of power through federalism and to be able to change the principles of the system, if you will, without destroying its form, and at the same time guarantee the rights of the people and democracy
right.
in our society. And if you know anything about the 18th century, and especially the period, the early national period, you recognize that we were at a moment when Hamilton completely controlled the administration of John Adams, when the Federalists were on the verge of being able to convert our society from a democratic society into an aristocratical society or an oligarchy. We were right there, and Jefferson and Madison realized that if the balance would determine the future of America. And so Jefferson alluded to this again and again in his correspondence and letters to his friends, and he always talked about the Revolution of 1800 being a pivotal point. And for the life of me, I was a graduate student because I wrote the book 40 years ago. I never understood why nobody had ever written about it. Mm. There was a guy named John Hicks who wrote a textbook called The Federal Union that was the only book that featured anything about the Revolution of 1800, and that was only a page and a half. And he wrote the book in the 30s.
Wow.
And so I started looking at this, and I was at a place called the Center for the Study of Democratic Institutions, and there were a lot of people around me who were well-versed in philosophy and revolution and ideas. And so I was getting an education about the idea of revolution, and I was running across all this material that Jefferson was talking about and thinking to myself, this is one of the great discoveries, and this is one of the great feats or accomplishments of America's democracy and its contribution to the world.
So to put this in plain English, we had the first two administrations. You had George Washington, 1789, when the Constitution was ratified until 1796, right? And then in 1796, John Adams became our second president, and he was running for re-election in 1800. When during that time of period, that brief period in time from 1789 when we became the modern republic that we are until 1800, through the end of John Adams' presidency. When did we start turning in an aristocratic direction, in kind of a Koch brothers direction, let the rich run the country? How did that happen? Give me some specifics. Give me some examples.
Okay. I would say that the time that Jefferson resigns as Secretary of State, which is in December of 1793.
Now, this is still the George Washington administration.
Right, right. The last 2 years of Washington's administration, there is abundant evidence that Washington was starting to lose his powers of rationality and his control of the situation, and he was deferring again and again to Alexander Hamilton. And there is no question that Hamilton identified with Robert Walpole, who was the leader of the Commons from 1720 to 1742. In fact, Hamilton was often considered the Walpole of America. And his conception of politics was not limited by the Constitution or anything else. It was a politics of interest and factions. Mm. And factions, as defined in that first chapter in the book, deal with the idea of power. And political parties and factions are synonymous. I mean, there's no difference between them in the minds of the framers. And I believe that it is this understanding of the fundamental nature of politics that we have gotten away from in our society, and we have adopted, say, you know, by the 1820s and 30s, the notion that the party system is the triumph of American politics, when in fact we can't understand what's going on in our own government because we're blinded by the idea of party.
Right.
I think that what we need to do is to get back to this understanding of what are factions, and all of a sudden, if you do that, you see and comprehend precisely what all the hubbub and commotion today is of special interest and, you know, the people on Wall Street milking the economy, and it goes on and on. And most people are so blinded by party rhetoric and the promise of politicians, they forget about those 200,000 lobbyists that descend on Capitol Hill every morning
right.
to work their will.
So to rather than dealing with this at the level of abstraction, I'd like to get to the level of actual stories. You know, what were some of the events? You had Hamilton was a fatherless child. He was,
to quote John Adams, he was the bastard brat of a Scottish farmer.
Right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And who was born in what's
British,
that island?
West Indies.
Yeah, in the British West Indies. Mm-hmm. And always had this inferiority complex, apparently, you know, wanted to be, you know, a big shot. In fact, wanted.
Well, you can't misunderestimate him. I mean, he was the aide-de-camp to Washington during the Revolutionary War. He was one of the leading generals, a very aggressive commander in the field. He proved his mettle, I mean, his courage and everything else. So, and he wrote the Federalist Papers next to Madison.
Right.
And I think did a fantastic job. And so he was a man who understood both sides of the question, but he was attempting to manipulate it like a lobbyist today would in terms of dealing with our system. And so
was there a particular product or a particular item that, or
well,
was
it was
the
an
banking?
Imperial system. Right. If you remember, there was something called the Bank Bill that was passed during Washington's era. And Hamilton was the evil genius behind it.
Right, this created the first Bank of the United States.
Turn over the Bank of the United States, but it was going to turn over the financing of it and the privileges that went with that to the aristocrats who had existed within the British Empire.
Whoa.
And Hamilton was always sympathetic to the British. In fact, there's a great book called Agent 007 that was written by a Hamilton scholar, in which the evidence is right clear that Hamilton had given all of our secrets over to the British diplomats and the British ministry.
Alexander Hamilton,
absolutely.
AKA
today
Benedict
he would
Arnold.
Have been charged with treason, and I mean he was a double agent. That's what it amounts
to. That's an amazing story.
And
we're talking with Dan Sisson. He's the author of The American Revolution of 1800: How Jefferson Rescued Democracy from Tyranny and Faction, and what that means today. We're going to get into what that means today. And also, we'll be taking your questions for Dan. So if you have any questions about the early history of this country, give us a shout.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
The book is just out. It's just showing up in bookstores and online electronically, or online stores. The American Revolution of 1800 by Dan Sisson. So, Dan, tell me about the banking bill. I know that our Fed, for example, right now, is owned by the 10 or 12 member banks, and those banks are owned in turn by smaller banks that own stock in that bank.
That's the Federal Reserve system, right?
Right,
1913.
Yeah. Right. But, our Fed is arguably in private hands, or at least to some extent. But what was Hamilton's visualization of the original bank? And because this became hugely contentious. I mean, didn't Andrew Jackson run on a campaign of shutting down
the
bank and won president?
And establishing banks in the West so he could expand the appeal to democratic interests. Hmm. And the people in the Eastern Seaboard at the time of the 1790s, they were people you remember who had made their fortunes under a British empire. And these were Hamilton's natural constituents. It would be almost like Schumer, the senator from New York, and the people that he would appeal to get elected, who would be the multimillionaires in New York City in the financial district.
Right.
And so Hamilton was at one point the senator from New York. He was also, you know, one of the leading statesmen in New York. And so these were the people that he wanted to turn to. And he knew that they would be able to run the country, even though they made their fortunes, but it would give a certain what you might call imperial majesty to the financial system. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is what he was looking for. He wanted to guarantee where all the money would go. And I think that when you talk to anybody who's, at Goldman Sachs or whatever, they would use the same arguments that Hamilton did.
Right.
Yeah, global capitalism. I mean, that's basically what he was about.
That was Alexander Hamilton. Now, meanwhile, and I don't recall if I read this in your book or if, I've read so many books in this era, John Adams had passed a rule, I guess it was, that whenever he and Abigail came through a town, that the local militia had to show up, they had to line the street on both sides, they had to fire the cannons in the air, and the mayor or the highest official in the town had to shout, "God save President Adams and his wife." And there's this.
And that's the parallel symbolically to "God save the king."
Yeah, of course. And in my book, We the People, I tell this story about how the town drunk in his name was Luther Baldwin, and it was in one of these towns in New Jersey. I forget the name of the town, but anyhow, he was sitting in a bar, and the bartender who owned the bar was a Federalist, and Luther Baldwin either didn't know or didn't care because he was so drunk, and he said, and the cannons went off as John Adams was going down the street, and he says, "They're firing the cannons. I don't care if they fire one in his arse." And so this guy turns him in, and Luther Baldwin spends the next 2 years in prison because he insulted the President of the United States under the Alien Sedition Acts.
Right.
I mean, that's the direction America was going.
Absolutely. And shutting down newspapers and arresting editors, intimidating them. And Jefferson and Madison looked at this with absolute, you know, horror because they realized that the whole spirit of our system depends on a free press. And if you can intimidate the press, then you can change the direction of the system.
Right.
And I think that Madison and Jefferson both were as much concerned about the principles as they were about the form. In fact, in my book, and you're also the co-author of this book, so you endorse this, without understanding the connection between principles and forms, you can't preserve the system.
Right.
And if you look at America today, one of the things you see is there's almost a total lack of discussion of principles at any level. Because to have principles, you have to be consistent and have integrity to reinforce them. And so what we see is that factions everywhere are rearing their ugly heads, and they're being able to do things to achieve power and their ultimate objective, but they don't have to relate to principles. And Jefferson and Madison would have said this is not the way to preserve a republic.
We'll be right back with more advances. Twenty minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Dan Sisson in the studio with us. It's our American Revolution 101 hour, and we will be picking up your phone calls for Dan right after the bottom of the hour. But first, I just want to get through the book here, or the beginning of the book.
Yeah.
And we were talking about, you know, why did Jefferson actually said the election of 1800 was a revolution in the real sense of the word. I'm paraphrasing. You probably know the exact quote.
The exact quote is, it was as much a revolution in the principles of government as 1776 was in its form.
Wow.
What we were talking about just a minute
right.
ago.
Yeah, this is serious stuff. And so what had happened was during the Washington administration, you had Hamilton pushing the government, and Jefferson was Secretary of State up until the last 2 years, and he resigned and said, "Screw this! This isn't going the way I wanted." And he'd had these long battles with Hamilton. I mean, in my book Rebooting the American Dream, I open with Hamilton's 11-point plan for manufacture, And half of that is his rebuttal of Jefferson's idea of an agrarian society. I mean, these guys were just in war with each
other. That's right.
But anyhow, so we had Hamilton and the other Federalists and High Federalists, and Washington was a Federalist, but sort of, you know, he was less political, shall we say.
I would suggest that most people don't realize this, but Washington's farewell address is probably the clearest exposition on the relationship between faction and party that has ever been written, even more so than Madison's Federalist Number 10 in the Federalist Papers.
Yeah. And didn't Madison ghostwrite it?
Well, Madison wrote the first draft, and Hamilton, 4 years later, wrote the second draft or went over it. And so all of a sudden, you see the confluence of the two major factions who were operating at that time agreeing on the definition of faction and party. Right. It's a marvelous coincidence. But I think the most important part of this story is that, like today when we talk about, you know, when George Bush was the president of the United States and the influential people in his administration and how Cheney was sometimes referred to as Mr. President, et cetera, what we see is that Hamilton had complete control of Adams' cabinet when he was the president for 4 years. Hamilton would tell the members what to vote on. He knew what the agenda was.
Jefferson was the vice president, but he was basically not on speaking terms with Adams.
I would agree that they didn't speak very much, but they had an affection for one another. Hmm. And that went back to the time of the Revolution.
Right.
And remember that Jefferson had spent more time with John Quincy Adams than even his father had. That's what Abigail said in her correspondence.
So Jefferson was sort of a surrogate father for John Adams' son.
He sure was. Very, very close. And it turned out that there's a part of the book really shows a connection at the end of 1800 when Adams, who was so irate about Hamilton's attempts to deter and limit his policies, like criticizing his rapprochement with France and virtually everything that Adams tried to do, Adams would go to Braintree, Massachusetts to get away because he couldn't get any resolution from his own cabinet because he knew they were being disloyal. Like a contemporary president who has all these forces contending against what he wants to do, the military-industrial complex, for instance, right now,
right.
And he doesn't seem to be able to get his message across or do what he wants to do. And so Adams, in a sense, he ended up abolishing the United States Army. Can you imagine a president today abolishing the Pentagon? Because he knew that Hamilton was the number one general in the country, and he had been at the head of, 13,000 troops during the Whiskey Rebellion, and he had already revealed to many of his high Federalists that this was a contest between states' rights and the central government, and some of the Federalists were proposing that we abolish the states under the new government.
Wow.
And so Hamilton was a radical thinker along these lines. He was willing to do away with what Jefferson and Madison both said was the most ingenious device ever invented by man, which was federalism, which reduced the power of the central government so it could be manageable.
Right. Which conservatives give lip service today to, but is really the antithesis of the principal Republican big R.
Absolutely.
Position. But so here we have an era where John Adams is caught up in all these cross currents. Alexander Hamilton is virtually mounting a coup, and in the midst of this, John Adams decides that he gets the Alien Sedition Act passed in 1798, the day that it's signed, in fact, the day before it was signed, he throws Ben Franklin's grandson, Benjamin Franklin Bach, into prison. You know, it's like he's putting all these guys in jail. Jefferson left town the day it was signed, so he wouldn't have anything to do with it. This is how bad it was getting.
It was getting bad. You think about the NSA and surveillance, and you think about Ferguson, Missouri. And we have these instances in which the government really is betraying the interests of the people. And this is what this whole period really is about. In fact, I was going to suggest that if you really look at the 1790s and you look at the politics of 2014, you don't see very much difference. And what that tells me is that America is now entering a period in which revolution is very possible. In fact, we may even be in the beginnings of a revolution with the recognition that inequality is playing a major role, the middle class is disappearing, you know, some of our rights are disappearing.
Now, you're not talking shooting revolution, you're talking like FDR revolution?
Well, basically what I'm talking about is a revolution that is based upon the fundamental principles of man and Republican society.
Smaller Republican. Okay, we'll be back with Dan Sisson right after this. Stick around.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Dr. Dan Sisson is with us. The book, The American Revolution of 1800, How Jefferson Rescued Democracy from Tyranny and Faction and What This Means Today. Welcome back to the place where despair is not an option, the Tom Hartman Program. In the studio with me, Dan Sisson, historian, author, professor, the new book, The American Revolution of 1800, and it really, this was a moment in our time, Dan, when Hamilton and buddies were taking us full board Koch brothers. We were turning into Koch brothers America.
Precisely.
And Thomas Jefferson said no, and he was sort of the FDR of his era, would you say? I mean, because libertarians and Republicans love to idealize Jefferson, as do liberals, and that makes a confusing history.
And I think we have become confused, and I think you're right about this. Ever since we became infatuated with extreme materialism, you know, the pursuit of wealth, we have tended to say that we love Thomas Jefferson and his spirit, but we identify with Alexander Hamilton in terms of our material goals. I think I heard that from some guy named Tom Hartman.
Yeah, but the old joke is we all talk about Jefferson's America, but we live in Hamilton's America.
That's it.
Yeah.
And so what we've done is in the late 20th century, we have sort of slowly, especially with the accretion of American power and responsibilities and keeping the world sea lanes open and, you know, organizing our NATO members and all the rest, we've sort of gotten away from Jefferson's idea of the republic. And I think that the book really promises the reader a sort of an overview of an American idea of revolution. I don't know anything else that's been written in American history like it, or politics. It talks about the role of conspiracy in revolution, which is a part of revolutionary theory.
What is the role of conspiracy in revolution?
Well, the notion of conspiracy stems from the classical origins of what a republic is like, which the Founding Fathers believed in, that you could not have any opposition group in the society. And so any group that would disagree with the administration in power was viewed as a conspiracy. Remember, this is the first republic in 2,000 years.
Right.
Nobody had ever seen one before. And so the framers were attempting to figure out how to preserve republican principles, but at the same time, how to put down any potential conspiracy that would overthrow the government. And so they saw all these conspiracies, and they were always alluding to Caesar and Catiline's conspiracy and all the rest when they were talking about faction. And so when we look at the Koch brothers and we realize they're spending hundreds of millions, if not billions of dollars, trying to alter the political system, even when we look at the Supreme Court in Citizens United, who in their right mind in the 18th century would ever think that money in politics was not going to result in corruption?
Right.
It's like an equation.
So what would Jefferson, Madison, what would the people of that era say about today's politics?
They would be absolutely inflamed. The first thing that Jefferson and Madison would do was to say that we have to resort to federalism and go to local control and get local communities enraged about what is going on and inform them and get them organized. And somewhere I heard, maybe it was your program, about a month ago, you had a person here from a place in North Carolina, I think it was Mitchell County, in which the Republican registration was 89%, and the people got so inflamed with what is going on down there that they signed up something like 30, 40,000 voters, and they're going to turn it around come right. election. Right. That's what we have to do.
Right.
And that's a peaceful politics. Formula, yeah. A peaceful resolution, which I think is a very positive view about the potential for American politics.
That's great. Let's pick up some phone calls here. We've got people who have questions for you. And Linda in Santa Monica, California, you're on the air with Dan Sisson. Thanks, Linda, for calling. Linda?
Hello?
Hi, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi. Okay. Yes, I have a question that I have for 25 years asked every leftist scholar from Michael Parenti to John Stockwell to Carl Boggs, and nobody has been able to give me an answer to this, and that is, why are the elections held on November 4th in the middle of the winter during business hours? Well, we know why, because they didn't want the, you know, poor to vote. And everybody else holds it on the weekends, and nobody can tell me, where did this originate with November 4th Tuesday? Or, you know.
Yeah, the first or second Tuesday in November.
Well, I'm not really sure that I can answer that, to tell you the truth. I never really thought about that. When presidential terms and election dates were established, it seems to me that there's a colonial precedent for this of voting in the fall. And when you
town meetings were held after the crops were brought in.
Yeah.
People had a little time.
And I think that's probably the best answer, is that we're an agricultural society at this time and everybody is harvesting.
Yeah. And by November the harvest was in and people were starting to do canning and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
But I wonder if the first Tuesday thing, it was a Masonic thing. You know, I wonder
I'm
if there
sure.
was some
That's
significance to that
I
day
just
of the week.
Know.
Yeah,
I wish I could answer your question, madam.
Good question. Michael in Imperial Beach, California. You're on the air with Dan Sisson.
Hey, Mr. Hartman and Mr. Sisson. Mr. Sisson, Tom said once that the system back then used to be that whoever got the most electoral votes got the presidency, Adams, and whoever got the second most electoral votes got the vice presidency, Jefferson. I was wondering, when was the first election that happened when whoever won the Electoral College got to choose his own vice president? Thank you, gentlemen.
This was an amendment to the Constitution during Jefferson's presidency, wasn't it?
The 12th Amendment made a distinction between the president and the vice president on the ballot. But that's not really what you're asking. We didn't establish the whole business of the leading candidate choosing his running mate until after Martin Van Buren, who was an expert in party politics and had later became president himself. And the party system became ensconced in our political life. And so the ticket or the party, and because of election, I mean, Jefferson's experience with Burr, nobody wanted to repeat that again. So everybody was conscious.
What was the experience nobody wanted to repeat?
Well, they both got the same number of electoral votes because they slipped up when it came time to putting the names on the ballot.
Uh-huh.
And so every time somebody voted for Jefferson, they also voted for Burr. And when they went to the House of Representatives, remember, Adams came in third, Burr began to conspire behind the scenes with the Federalists so that he would be named the president. And this is part of the drama in the book, is how Hamilton and a whole group of other important people in our history all conspired to act illegally. So the notion that you would use, say, the Bush-Gore election and a Supreme Court making things like, I mean, what was one justice said, stop the counting of the votes? I mean, this is a typical thing that's been going on in our politics for two centuries. And this is part of a republic. And remember, you go back to the idea of faction, and if you start to think about this for a while, all of a sudden, all of these forces become a lot clearer when you get away from party rhetoric and all the promises that are made by party politicians but are never acted upon.
So define faction.
Yeah.
Define faction. What do you mean when you say faction?
A faction, as say by James Madison, who's the father of our Constitution, was a group of people in the minority or the majority who would work in a way whose interests were adverse to the community or the nation.
Whoa. So it wasn't just a special interest group. It is a special interest group whose particular special interest is adverse to the health of the nation.
Yeah, and any factions is interested only in its own.
So faction, by definition, is sinister. I mean, it's by definition, it's
majority. And they use that word again and again.
Sinister.
It's sinister.
Faction.
It's vindictive. It's seeking for. It's lustful of power and dominion.
Wow.
Yeah. Both Hamilton and Jefferson.
And billionaires who want to take over the political system today just so that they can get their taxes lowered or less regulation on their oil refineries or their paper plants. This would be a faction.
Oh, boy.
Right?
Oh, absolutely. You can define,
sense.
You know, all these people, the oil interest in our society. And if you think about the inheritance tax and how they've set up an aristocracy in terms of perpetuation of wealth for their own families. I mean, let's face it. The people in some of these families, the sons and daughters and grandsons and granddaughters will never have to work.
Right.
Ever.
Right.
That's not the American way.
Yeah, there you go. And not just granddaughter. I mean, we're talking in sons. We're talking 10, 20. The five heirs to the Walton family have more wealth than the bottom 40% of America.
Right.
I mean, they're not going to have to work.
They'll never have to work.
Yeah, that's amazing. Morris in Long Beach, California. Hey, Morris, thanks for listening to KPFK. You're on with Dan Sisson.
Is there a correlation between the local militias of that era and today's street police? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Morris.
A correlation between
the local militias of that day and today's police departments? Or would a better analogy be today's state National Guards?
Well, I would suggest that that the local militia stemmed from the period of the Revolution. They were volunteers that would come together to defend the interests of the local citizens. That became legalized under local customs and state constitutions, and even the federal government was expected to kick in money to maintain the state militia.
And in some of these states, in Virginia and South Carolina, North Carolina, Georgia, these were also the slave patrols.
Absolutely. And we know, at least Tom and I have been involved in some research on this point, in which if anybody would go to the Virginia ratifying constitutional convention, in which this was critical and crucial for bringing the Union together, because if it had not been ratified, there would have been no United States. One of the things that surfaces when you look at all the letters is that the leading aristocrats at that time, I'm talking about George Mason and
Patrick Henry,
people like him.
Largest slaveholder in Virginia.
That's right. Like, and they were trying...
We want our militia, damn it. They were the Second Amendment.
Even more than that, Tom. I think that what they were trying to do was to co-opt the United States government into supporting slavery in an overt level.
Program. Visit TomHartmann.com for audio and video archives.
So you're saying that what they really wanted to do was get the entire federal government to support slavery nationwide.
Not only that.
Amazing. Hang on. Welcome back. Finish your thought, Dan.
Okay. We have to give, I think, credit to James Madison, because Madison was the one who arbitrated the settlement, and his basic conclusion was, are not going to put that in the Constitution because these people are going to be free, and we're going to just pass something, a legislation later on in the first Congress maybe, and hence the Fugitive Slave Act, in which we had federal marshals going down and retrieving runaway slaves and stuff. But Madison was smart enough, as was Jefferson, not to make that the fundamental part of our law, to maintain the notion that all men are created equal. And I don't think they're given enough credit for that.
Even though they were both slaveholders.
That's right.
Jefferson spent most of his career trying to fight against slavery. He was John Quincy Adams' surrogate father. John Quincy Adams was so opposed to slavery that after his presidential term, he went back and ran for the House of Representatives specifically to stop slavery in the United States.
He fought the gag rule every day.
Yeah, literally every day.
And I want to put something forward that very few people have ever mentioned, especially Jefferson scholars. We live in a time in which Jefferson's commitment to slavery has been questioned by Winchak and a bunch of others. But I would say that Jefferson tried more than any other human being alive in that era to eliminate slavery by legislation, and he was defeated 12 times by solid majorities in every forum that he tried to do it in, whether it was a Continental Congress or whether it was a Virginia state legislature. And what Jefferson did as a desperate measure, finally, says, I'm going to figure out a way to convert these people. And so he founded the University of Virginia when he was in his 70s. He designed the buildings and the campus, and he wrote the curriculum, and he hired the professors. And he said, you know, he didn't say this overtly, but the implication was, we're going to liberally educate the citizens of this state so that they will understand why people desire freedom. Hmm. And sure enough, if the Civil War had waited another 4 or 5 years before it started, Jefferson would have won, because Virginia would have never gone into the Confederacy. It would have gone into the Union. They only failed by, I think it was either 1 or 3 votes.
Whoa.
Yeah, most people don't realize that.
Because of liberal arts education coming out of the University of Virginia?
Understanding of that Western liberal tradition about constitutionalism and John Locke and what people aspired to.
Right. Remarkable.
Yeah, these are the fundamentals. And we've got to get back to these fundamentals.
Yeah. We just have 1 minute until the break here. I'll pull a caller on after that minute. But after the Revolution of 1800, did the royalist forces, the Koch brother kind of forces, the oligarchic forces, Bernie Sanders, they kept coming back.
They tried to come back. But one of the things that we know, and this is featured in our book, is that Jefferson, who's observing what is happening to these forces, is saying to some of his correspondents, he's saying, Monroe's election will achieve 24 years of the inculcation of Republican principles into the minds of our citizens, and they will be irreversible. And then he said, and the greatest victory of all, it will remain, and this is a perfect, I mean, this is a full quote, it will attain the complete suppression of party.
Wow. Okay, and he saw this through the presidency of Jefferson, Madison, and Monroe.
Right.
These three presidents.
Right. And remember, Jefferson was the one who said, if I couldn't go to heaven but with a party, I wouldn't go at all.
Amazing. We'll be right back with more of Dan Sisson right after this. Stick around. Tom Hartman here with you. David in Halfway, Missouri. You're on the air with Dan Sisson.
Yeah, hi, Dan. I know you guys were talking about, you know, conspiracy and how important conspiracy laws were back then. And I was wondering what you think about the Aspen, the people, all the oligarchs meeting in Aspen. It's like a huge caucus room conspiracy to me. I think it's dangerous.
There's a bunch of Republicans and billionaires getting together in Aspen to have these strategy meetings. What would the founders have thought of that?
Well, I think that they would have seen it as a reflection of basic human nature, and they would have felt the calling or the responsibility or even the duty to oppose this with all their might by educating people like, you know, what the Tom Hartman program is about, basically, and other programs should be as well. And we have to get people to become aware of what threats these people are intending for our form of government, never mind the principle, because if we have a concatenation of these interests, we better believe that under the current system that we are going to drift increasingly toward an oligarchical society.
Yeah.
In fact, we may already be there, and this is what I was referring to earlier in the program about the possibility that America is now in the emergence stages of a real revolution.
Pete in Berkeley Heights, New Jersey, you're on the air.
Yes. Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. I really am enjoying this guest, but I did have some questions about, as I understood this, and I'm, by the way, in modern politics, I'm a liberal Democrat, but in looking back in history, I mean, Hamilton, with the idea of manufacturing a stronger central government, those things proved to make us the superpower that we are today, number one. And number two, every time it seems that rights are being trampled in the last part of the 20th century, it was these states' rights violations down south of civil rights that the federal government, the stronger federal government, had to step in and take its place. So realizing that Jefferson may have been combating some oligarchic, tendencies and indications, it still seems to me that the other side of the story is if we didn't become a modern country, a modern nation with a strong constitution and a strong central government, I don't think we would have been here. So I'd just like to hear Dan's comments on that.
Sure.
Your comments.
Yeah.
Okay, well, I can give you a halfway answer out there in halfway, and that is that you have to have a strong and progressive interpretation of federalism here, because while you're right, perfectly right, about looking at some of the southern states and their attempts to take away voting rights, which we see increasingly in our time, and we can look at the people in the south during Reconstruction and the Ku Klux Klan, etc., you also have to realize that above that 36-30 line, there are all those northern states that, and most of them, have traditionally expanded their rights. And so we see that under federalism that both are possibilities. And when I quoted earlier an experiment down in Mitchell County, North Carolina, this is below the Mason-Dixon line, and these guys have turned the situation around, at least for their county. And
but the question, if we talk about Jefferson,
right,
but we live in Hamilton's world, isn't that a good thing that this strong federal government has come to be and that it got actually stronger after the Civil War, or is that not a good thing?
Well, I think it was an inevitable thing, and I think that it represents the bringing together of economic forces in a continental system. It was expected that eventually the federal government would become more powerful than individual states, whereas in Jefferson's time, if Virginia had seceded from the Union or North Carolina, as some of them proposed, it would have destroyed the Union. Right. We don't have to look at that now. We've already gone through that with the Civil War. But I would say that we have taken Hamilton's vision to the point where our Republican institutions are in jeopardy.
Small R Republican.
Yeah.
The institutions.
That's
of our
right.
Republic,
the small R Republic.
We yeah.
And we're worried that there isn't going to be much of a republic left if we have an administration that wants to centralize even more power.
Yeah.
This is a danger.
Yeah. Jim in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. You're on with Dan. Quick one, please, Jim. We just have a couple minutes left.
I just got a comment. These fundamentals that we say that we should get back to, I'm all for it, you know, but I think it might have really worked back in the day. I mean, back when all those people were making this country what it is today. But with the amount of people that are in the country now and the mixed races and don't even know anything about our past history, I think that kind of a task to even try to get back to it is impossible.
Well, there's two pieces to that. Let's deal with the racial part separately because I don't think we have time for that. But
divide the country along racial lines this way. What I'm seeing is a university professor that I have all kinds of races in my classes and they perform equally well. I would say that the Asian minorities in my classes are never at a loss for a good explanation about things, and many of them were born into totalitarian systems. So I would think that as human beings, we're all capable of learning what our institutions are about.
So his concern about the general political ignorance of Americans.
Yeah, now that's
what do we do about that?
That is a really fine statement that you've made, and I'm concerned about that. I think that we have to redouble, maybe triple, our efforts at educating Americans about the issues that really matter. I don't want to put a blast out against American history and historians, but if you look at John Meacham's book and some of the others that have talked about Jefferson and Adams recently, then what you find out is that they don't even mention the Revolution of 1800, even on one page, even in the index. And so what we're talking about is an ignorance of our history. We've got to get back to a better understanding of some of these issues and especially the issues that defined us.
That America was born in revolution.
You bet.
That we've experienced revolution multiple times and that we may be on the edge of another one, which might make for a much better and stronger country. Dan Sisson, the author of The American Revolution of 1800, How Jefferson Rescued Democracy from Tyranny and Faction and What This Means Today, with a foreword by Tom Hartman. The book is available in bookstores right now and online. Check it out. Dan, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks.
And don't forget, democracy begins with you. Get out there, get active, tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to TomHartman.com.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com. Total protection. Quicken Loans. Engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com. Your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartmann.com.